This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele, the duo behind the Comedy Central sketch comedy series Key and Peele. A lot of Key and Peele's comedy is about race. They each have a white mother and black father and are perfectly comfortable satirizing white people and African Americans as well as everybody else. Key and Peele met in Chicago when they were part of the improv scene and worked together on the sketch comedy series Mad TV. Their Comedy Central show, Key and Peele, wraps up its third season on December 18th. Terry began our interview with Key and Peele by playing a clip of one of their sketches that went viral on the internet. It introduced the character of Luther, President Obama's anger translator.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. Now, before I begin, I just want to say that I know a lot of people out there seem to think that I don't get angry. That's just not true. I get angry a lot. It's just that the way I express passion is different from most. So, just so there's no more confusion, we've hired Luther here to be my anger translator. Luther?
Hi.
First off, concerning the recent developments in the Middle Eastern region, I just want to reiterate our unflinching support for all people and their right to a democratic process.
Hey, all y'all dictators out there, keep messing around and see what happens. Just see what happens. Watch!
Also, to the governments of Iran and North Korea, we once again urge you to discontinue your uranium enrichment program.
Hey, Mahmoud, Kim Jong, I think I already done told both y'all, 86 your I'm gonna come over there and do it for y'all. Please test me and see what happens.
On the domestic front, I just want to say to my critics, I hear your voices, and I'm aware of your concerns.
So maybe if you could chill the hell out for like a second, then maybe I can focus on some shit, you know?
That goes for everybody, including members of the Tea Party.
Oh, don't even get me started on these motherfuckers right here.
I want to assure you that we will be looking for new compromises with the GOP in the months ahead.
And you know these motherfuckers won't say no before I even suggest some
Now, I know a lot of folks say that I haven't done a good job at communicating my accomplishments to the public.
Because y'all don't listen!
Since being in office, we've created 3 million new jobs.
3 million new jobs!
We ended the war in Iraq.
Ended a war, y'all! We ended a war! Remember that?
These achievements should serve as a reminder that I am on your side.
I am not a Muslim!
And that my intentions as your president are coming from the right place.
They're coming from Hawaii, which is where I'm from, which is in the United States of America, y'all. Okay? This is ridiculous. I have a birth certificate. I have a hot, diggity, doggity, mama say, mama samu, maku saw a birth certificate, you dumbass crackers.
Okay. So, Luther, rope it in.
You dialed it back, Luther, damn.
Keegan-Michael Key, Jordan Peele, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for being here. So let's start with the sketch that we just heard. How did you come up with the idea for the Obama anger translator?
Well, we were sitting around writing the pilot for the show, actually, in Jordan's apartment. And we were trying to figure out, we knew we wanted to do something with Obama because we actually felt that Obama was kind of responsible for us even getting a show in the first place, because there's this biracial person who might, you know, have to ride the divide between two different races. And we weren't sure exactly how we wanted to do it. But we kind of went through a bunch of ideas, and then we decided. Jordan has a really amazing Obama impersonation.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
And something that kind of inspired us a little bit was, if you remember, Garrett Morris used to say on Saturday Night Live when they do the Weekend Update.
Oh, the hearing impaired thing.
Yeah, the hearing impaired thing when he'd scream, you know, President Francisco Franco is still dead. You know, that whole thing.
Right, he'd shout it real loud for the hearing impaired. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Right. And I remember Jordan was saying, you know what? Something that what if? Here's the thing. We know we're frustrated when a person like Joe Wilson had screamed during that State of the Union address when he was like, "You lie" to the president, and we were like, the president can't react the way millions of Americans right now are going, oh, God, he can't say anything. He can't rail at this man. He can't get upset. What if we had a surrogate who could get upset for him? And that was that was the embryonic stage of creating Luther, so that he'd have somebody who could translate him when he's having like an internal fit of pique, but could do it externally for him.
this was also in the peak of the birther movement and things like that. So there were all these little issues that we felt were going unaddressed by Obama, because I think, you know, the way we've described it before is that he couldn't come off like an angry black man, especially early on. So, you know, this what Luther says kind of is are things that ring true to us, and we felt like it was giving the truth a voice in a lot of ways.
Right. Yeah.
Jordan, when you met President Obama, which I know you did you get some insights into how to perform him?
I would say so. Yeah, I think I walked out of there a little bit more confident with my impression, and I actually did it for him at one point. And he says, you know, I'll do a pretty good me myself. He said something like that. But you know, he is a close talker. He's a touchy guy. Like he will.
He is a very tactile individual.
He will touch you on the shoulder, and you know, kind of, you know, in the so that big brother or father figure kind of way, and you really do feel sort of shepherded by him. He's very funny. So I think after meeting him, I was inclined to turn up the humor of him, that he has a sense of humor. And again, I think that is also something he, in the beginning of his presidency, he couldn't really explore and couldn't show. You know, he had to be almost a one-dimensional, stoic leader during that first election.
You're going to bring out the anger translator to talk about Obama's anger at the Obamacare website?
Well, I think that may happen. We're kind of cooking something up right now. That's I don't even know if it's confidential, but we're cooking something up right now to do for about the ACA. But as otherwise, I think Luther is. I mean, I think Luther is raring to go. He's like, who the hell? Come on, who doesn't want health care? Go ahead, break your leg then. You know what? Even better. I'm going to come over there and break your leg for
all
you.
Right,
and then we'll see. Okay. Sorry, Luther, sir. I apologize, sir.
Keep it together.
People is crazy. Yep. People is stupid.
People is,
and I'm
going to
say it right now. Mostly white people. Stupid.
All right. Well,
young white man, 26.
Rope it in.
Get your act together.
Let's not make it racial. Let's not make anything racial.
That's fabulous.
Ever.
I apologize, sir. I apologize.
Oh, my guests are Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele, and together they're Key and Peele. They have their own sketch comedy show on Comedy Central. A character you do, Keegan, that I really love is the substitute teacher. And this is this is a teacher who's taught in in an inner city school for like 20 years, and now he's teaching in like a middle class school that's like somewhere at approximately 100% white.
That's right.
I want to play the first of these sketches that you did with the substitute teacher. And then we'll talk about the character some more. But first, just like physically describe how you look in this sketch so we can get an image in our minds.
Well, I think what you're dealing with is a guy who has a real kind of military persona about him. He's very rigid and a little haggard, yet still aggressive. He's got his hairline is really far back. He's been balding probably since his 20s, and he has a very kind of tight, like this isn't the best way to describe it, like a high and tight kind of mustache. So he looks like he might have been in the army or something, or an MP. And he wears a short sleeve drab shirt and like a twill tie. And he just looks all business. Like he's ready to rumble.
Okay, so this is the substitute teacher, performed by my guest Keegan-Michael Key.
All right, listen up, y'all. I'm y'all substitute teacher, Mr. Garvey. I taught school for 20 years in the inner city, so don't even think about messing with me. Y'all feel me? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take a roll here. Jay Quellen. Where's Jay Quellen at? No Jay Quellen here? Yeah.
Do you mean Jacqueline?
Okay. So that's how it's gonna be. Y'all wanna play. Okay then. I've got my eye on you, Jay Quellen. Balake. Where is Balake at? There's no Balake here today. Yes, sir.
My name's Blake.
Are you out of your damn mind?
Blake?
What? Do you want to go to war, Balaki?
Because we could go to war.
No.
I'm for real. I'm for real. So you better check yourself.
That's really great.
And I love it because it's Balaki. Balaki. It's got two different pronunciations.
Jordan, do you want to describe how you end the sketch?
And then, I believe Garvey says, Joe Nathan. And then,
is it Timothy?
It's Timothy.
Timothy.
Yes,
yeah,
yes, yeah. Yes. I mean, maybe at one point it was Joe Nathan.
It was Joe Nathan.
But yes, yeah. He says, Timothy. And then, you know, the first black student we've seen sort of emerges from behind a white student. Present. And then it's over. It's a pretty absurd little piece of heightening.
We went back and forth on present too. We're like, should he say, is that too silly?
Is that too silly?
Is present too silly?
Nobody says present.
Nobody. But everybody knows. But we just decided to go with it anyway. We had here. Mm-hmm. Present and just good old fashioned present, but
somehow it works.
Somehow it works. Yeah.
So, when you were in school, were there a lot of students in your classes that had names that their parents had obviously creatively made up from scratch?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
There were literally in my neighborhood. There were two kids. Now this is kind of a urban legend. Jordan and I both know this legend. Everybody knows this legend in kind of African American lore. There's always somebody in your neighborhood named Arangelo or Lamangelo. And that's spelled, Arangelo is spelled O-R-A-N-G-E-J-E-L-L-O. So, you know, that's, and then.
Right. Which, I mean, if we really, you know, dig deep into it, you know, especially when talking about African American culture,
sure.
It's got, you know, names have such a deep history, you know, just from having our names taken away in the first
right,
place.
Exactly,
sort of
right.
Renamed and, you know, now feels like 80% of African American population has the name Washington or Jefferson or some president or slave owner's name, and you know, I almost wonder, is this part of a way of taking back the principle of naming your I might be going too far into this, but
no,
yeah, naming your kid something of your choice.
Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele are the stars of Comedy Central's sketch comedy show Key and Peele. We'll get back to their conversation with Terry after a quick break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're listening to Terry's interview with Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele, the duo behind the Comedy Central sketch comedy series Key and Peele. Let's hear another scene from the show. This sketch is called School Bully. Key plays a student who's reading on the front steps of his school. Peele plays a bully who walks up to Key with a group of friends and starts taunting him. Later in the scene, the bully's dad, played by Andre Royo, who played Bubbles on The Wire, pulls up in a battered pickup truck.
Why you reading, bitch?
Because I like to read and this is a really good book. Why you gotta bother me, man?
Because I'm not doing very well at school. I'm reading at a third grade level. I really don't want to get left back. So when I see somebody reading for fun, it makes me feel that much more stupid. And then I get mad.
I didn't know that. Thanks so much for opening up to me.
Shut up, queer.
I don't understand. Why you got to go there?
I've been having sexual fantasies about some of the other guys at school.
What?
Give me that. I'm afraid of these feelings and what they might mean. It's like because I hate myself so much, I gotta point that hate outward towards you.
Okay. You understand this on such a deep level that
I don't understand. Now I'm gonna punish you physically for acknowledging my emotional problems.
I was gonna say, if you understand yourself so well, then maybe you should try working on changing it.
Of course I wanna change it. But it's the only defense mechanism I have against deeper, more terrifying problems buried inside of me. Lucky my dad's here.
Get the damn tuck, son. I need to take you home and beat on you because I hate myself. And you look like your mother who left me. And I'm going to block out the guilt I feel over mistreating you with the river of vodka.
I'm going to internalize that and unknowingly transfer it onto you tomorrow. Coming reluctantly.
That's a sketch from Key and Peele, which is a sketch comedy show on Comedy Central. I think before joining the cast of Mad TV, or maybe it was after that, that Jordan, you had auditioned for Saturday Night Live?
That was actually after. During my last year on Mad was the year of the writer strike. And there was an instance where we had a few episodes left of Mad TV, but there was this big question mark whether the show was going to come back at all. And within that time frame, yeah, I mean, Seth Meyers is a good buddy of mine, and this was also during the election, the Obama election. So he called me and he asked me if I had an Obama impression. I didn't at the time. But, you know, SNL had always been a dream of mine. And so, yeah, I worked on the impression for a week and then went out and flew out. And I was actually offered a job on the show, but I couldn't end up taking it because Mad TV ended up coming back after the strike. So, you know, there was, you know, basically I had four more episodes in my contract that overlapped and I didn't get to fly home and continue on that show.
Did both of you do a lot of, you know, characters or impressions when you first auditioned for Mad TV?
I did more characters. I mean, I had a lot of characters kind of in my bag from Second City.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some characters that had been incubating at the Second City in Chicago. And so, you know, when you're at Second City Chicago, kind of the unspoken thing is everybody's kind of, you're doing your work and you're making your art and you're having a good time. And it's really a kind of a fertile time in your life. But there's that thing in the back of your head that's saying, boy, you know, SNL might come calling or Mad TV might come calling. And so you're kind of like, I would just kind of catalog characters that I liked performing and that also that audiences seem to enjoy.
Jordan, what's one of the characters you developed early on that you could tell us about?
I was much more impression driven in my audition, and I mean, one of my impressions was I did Ja Rule. I did an impression of Ja Rule showing off his crib and cribs, and then on the other, you know, I went all the way to the other side. I did an impression of John Malkovich ordering a pizza, in which he does not want any of the extra bells and whistles. I just want a pepperoni pizza, please.
Hit him with some Morgan.
I did Morgan Freeman, of course. Yeah, Morgan Freeman. I don't remember what the context was. As sure as the black dots all over my face, I did this impression. Yeah, I was a part of this group called Boom Chicago in Amsterdam, and that's where I met Seth Meyers, Ike Barinholtz, Jason Sudeikis, some really amazing comedy performers, and we did sketch and improv there, in just a slightly different format than Keegan would have been doing at the Second City, but we had one short form improv game, where the audience would shout out impressions and then they would shout out locations. And we would literally just on the spot, whatever impression celebrity they gave us and location, we would have to become that celebrity in that location. And so I think in that process, I demystified the art of the impression for myself. And, you know, I think it's something that a lot of people think is magic, but it's, you know, just like anything else, you can learn to do it and get better at it.
Jordan, since you auditioned for Saturday Night Live and actually got hired but had to turn it down because you were still under contract to Mad TV, I was wondering if you've been following the recent controversy about the limited number of African-American comics, specifically women African-American comics that have been on the show through the history. There having been only three, and this came up after Kenan Thompson was interviewed, and he said that he and Jay Farrow didn't want to do characters in drag anymore, and Kenan Thompson said that it was hard to find African American women who were ready for Saturday Night Live, so that's led to a lot of discussion. And I'm wondering if either of you have anything you'd like to say about that.
It's on one hand, I do feel a little bit, you know, bad for Keenan, just knowing how, you know, an interview can go, and if you know, maybe he could have been more prepared for that question. But you know, I think, you know, for Keegan and I, we know so many hilarious African American women, and you know, we're mostly, you know, come up through the sketch and improv scene. Now there is a sketch and improv is a world that is dominated by white performers. That is true. But to say that there's not African American women who are ready is just wrong.
This
is incorrect. I mean, Naima Funk, Amber Ruffin,
yeah,
Claudia Wallace. You know, we really could go on.
Yeah, I mean, I think I completely agree with what Jordan said. I think you're right. That question might have snuck up on Keenan.
Yeah,
and also I think Keenan is in the midst of he does a job on a show that has a very specific skill set. I mean, it's a very specific skill set.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think. If that's the answer that came out of his mouth, I can understand that answer coming out of his mouth. But right now, I can think of three women who would murder on Saturday Night Live,
mm-hmm.
Either as writers or performers. And
Holly Walker, Liza Dye.
I would have to say, you know, with all deference to Keenan, I would have to say I definitely know that they are there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Since we're talking, go ahead.
Oh yeah, and also there's, you know, there is a world. Keegan and my race has really played to our advantage in the improv sketch world.
Small pool.
It's also a bit of a special power. I mean, we can do characters that other people would feel uncomfortable doing, and we can explore the. You know, just to be quite straightforward, we can play black characters and explore the comedy of black characters. Now, there's a whole world of characters and impressions that black women can do that other people just on the social level, not, you know, disregarding the practice and skill that goes into perfecting these things, but just on the social level, people would feel uncomfortable doing. So it's... they should hire some black women. not a black woman, some black women.
Black women, yeah.
Well, listen, since we've been talking about a controversial remark said in the context of an interview, I was wondering if either of you might be willing to say something that would be really controversial that will get us tweeted a lot. Anything?
What about white men? You know what? White men aren't funny.
There
white men
go.
Aren't ready to be on Saturday.
They are not ready.
Jordan, can you top that, please?
Let's see. I don't know if I can top that.
My nonsensical comment.
Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele are the stars of the Comedy Central sketch comedy series Key and Peele. You'll find a longer version of their conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. We're in the middle of the season when Hollywood rolls out its big awards contenders. This can make it hard for good foreign films and documentaries to get attention. Our critic-at-large John Power says there are two you should try and see. Paul Sorrentino's The Great Beauty, which is Italy's submission for the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar, and Shaul Schwartz's Narcocultura, a documentary about the drug war in Mexico and its influence on a popular musical form known as narco-corrido, songs that glorify drug traffickers. Power says that seeing the movies side by side made him remember a line he'd read in college.
In The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, William Blake served up one of those mind-bending proverbs he's known for. The road of excess leads, he wrote, to the palace of wisdom. I thought about this line as I watched two terrific new movies that put Blake's words to the test. Paolo Sorrentino's thrillingly good The Great Beauty tackles the idea head-on. It's an excessive film about excess. Sorrentino doesn't merely aim to update one of the most famous movies of all time, Fellini's Portrait of Decadent Rome, La Dolce Vita. He intends to better it. When we first meet the narrator hero, Jep Gambardella, he's hosting a party in his apartment overlooking the Colosseum. A techno-thumping bacchanalia, so hallucinatory, it's assaultive. brilliantly played by the great serpent-eyed actor Tony Servillo. Jep is a witty, jaded journalist who spends his time observing, hanging out with, and occasionally betting, Rome's vulgar, deeply corrupt elite. Rich businessmen and their neurotic wives, phony performance artists, and curdled aristocrats. Yet even as he haunts fashionable circles, Jep is haunted by what he's lost, the fire that burned inside him as a young novelist, not yet tainted by La Dolce Vita, the good life. Hoping to rekindle it, he wanders Rome, encountering everyone from a soulful stripper to a genius little girl painter to a celebrated old nun whose life is as self-denying as Jep's is pleasurable. At first, the great beauty plays like an enjoyably exuberant satire of modern Rome. Yet slowly, grandeur starts shining through the decadence. Sorrentino offers the most ravishing footage of Rome I've ever seen. He seems to have had free run of every park and palazzo. And the city's glory puts into perspective the shallowness within it. Scenes that start off satirical, like the one with the nun, wind up containing a vision of transcendence. By film's end, the road of excess has led Jep to a vision of life's great beauty, and perhaps his own spiritual resurrection. Now, it would be easy to write off Jep's whole story as a case of first-world problems. I wouldn't. The movie's about more than that. Still, Jep's troubles do seem mighty well upholstered next to the raw wounds in Narco Cultura, a disturbing verite documentary about the Mexican drug war. It was made by Shaul Schwartz, an Israeli war photographer who spent several years chronicling its devastation. Narco Cultura takes us inside and juxtaposes two very different cultures. The first is Ciudad Juarez. Schwartz shows what it means for a city to be the murder capital of the world, with a murder rate 30 times higher than Los Angeles. We see body parts on the streets, blood washed into gutters, the victims' terrified neighbors. And we follow Richie Soto, an honest CSI cop whose job it is to try to solve all these murders, a job he must conduct wearing a mask because so many of his colleagues are getting murdered. Meanwhile, in the safety of L.A., we meet Edgar Quintero, an amiable musician and doting father, whose songs are part of the Narco Corrido boom, a movement devoted to glorifying drug lords and celebrating the melodramatic glamour of the drug-dealing life. Many of these songs are commissioned by the gangsters themselves, but it's bigger than that. Like a jauntier, more brutal gangster rap, Quintero's songs pack nightclubs across America and Mexico with young folks singing merrily along to bouncy tunes about AK-47s and beheadings. Tellingly, the L.A.-based Narco Corrido entrepreneurs don't live such atrocities firsthand. Here, one of Quintero's musical buddies explains how they get their material from the internet.
Usually, all the information we get about Mexico is a narco blog, delnarco.com. You could see people like with their guts coming out from the stomach, their heads blown off, all real things, you know? That's how we get ideas. That's how we make our songs. You know, everything saying about, you know, Chapo Guzman or policías, the police officers kill.
At first, I feared that Schwartz was doing something worthy but obvious, showing how Narco Corrido songs and movies make people rich by falsifying the horrific reality of the drug biz. But gradually, you realize that things aren't so simple. Sure, Narco Corrido culture turns drug violence into a show, but there's also something merely theatrical about what the cops in Juarez are doing, too. Soto is an honorable man, but he and other local police don't really investigate 97% of the murders. To even talk about them would get them killed. Small wonder that so many powerless young Mexicans and Mexican-Americans don't trust the system, but get seduced by narco culture's vision of wealth and power and impunity. Heck, even when they're killed, drug lords get to dwell in self-aggrandizing tombs protected by bulletproof glass. If the great beauty ends with ecstatic hopes of rebirth, Narco Cultura ends in futility and despair. Forget about palaces of wisdom. In this world, the road of excess leads straight to the cemetery.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Coming up, journalist Adam Minter, author of the new book, Junkyard Planet. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. When you think of recycling, you probably think of bottles, cans, and newspapers. But what about the other stuff that gets recycled, the bigger stuff, the cars and electronics? Today we're going to learn about the hidden world of globalized recycling and reclamation as we listen to Terry's interview with Adam Minter, author of the new book Junkyard Planet. Minter writes about businesses devoted to recycling cars, Christmas lights, batteries, cell phones, computers, and more. Minter feels at home in junkyards because he kind of grew up in one. He's the son of a scrapyard owner, and his grandmother's father was a junk peddler. Now Minter is the Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg World View. He's covered the global recycling industry for more than a decade.
Adam Minter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
So you write that the global recycling industry employs more people than any other industry on the planet, except agriculture. That is a tribute to the amount of stuff we throw away.
It sure is. It's a tribute to the amount of stuff we throw away, and it's also a tribute to poverty and the lack of opportunities that a lot of folks in the developing world have to start their own businesses or find employment. You know, one of the things that I point out in the book is that this is the entrepreneurial opportunity of last resort. If you want to go into the scrap business or any kind of business, this is a great business to go into just because all you really need is a burlap sack so that you can pick up plastic bottles, say, beside the road. And if you travel the developing world and you know, and just look out the window of your car, you're going to see a lot of people doing this. And as the developing world develops, there's more and more trash and recycling for these people to pick up and sort through. And so it creates a tremendous opportunity.
I think it's fair to say that here in America, as big as the recycling industry might be, it's pretty much hidden from sight. And we really don't see what's happening globally because a lot of the recycling is happening in developing countries. So take us to a very small village in southern China, which is now the Christmas tree light recycling capital of the world. And let's start with this. Like, what do you do when you recycle a Christmas tree light? Like, what are you getting from it that's of value?
Right. Shijiao is the name of the town, and it was originally, like a lot of these southern Chinese towns, a town where there weren't many employment opportunities other than agriculture. And so people in that town started going into scrapping. And what scrapping meant was you find stuff down at the port that's imported, say, from the United States or Europe, and a lot of times that's wire. Useless wire that couldn't be recycled in the United States or the EU. So you bring it home and you basically set it on fire, and from that you extract copper. Christmas tree lights are an ideal product or commodity, if you will, for Chinese scrap recyclers to bring in. And the reason is that it's got very little copper in it, only about 28% for a load of Christmas tree lights. So in the United States, for example, where there's a lot of recycling of copper wire, the American recyclers prefer to recycle wire and cable that has generally more than 80% copper. So what they'll do is they'll export this stuff to China, where there's huge demand for copper. Roughly 43% of the global demand for copper is in China right now. And so they'll use mechanical means now to extract it. So because the materials become so expensive, they don't want to have charring on the copper. That makes it more difficult to melt in a furnace. But the other thing that happens is they want the insulation. You know, even 10 years ago, there was no market for insulation, recycling of insulation from Christmas tree lights in China. But as the price of oil has gone up and as China's drivers get on the road and start competing for gasoline with Americans, the demand for oil has gotten very high. So now they'll actually recycle the insulation off of these Christmas lights too.
And how, tell me again how the insulation's used?
Yeah, the insulation, it can be used in a lot of ways, but in Shijiao and at the plant that I profile in the book, at the beginning of the book, it's actually transformed into slipper soles. So they'll recover the insulation via shredding. So they'll shred the Christmas tree lights, and they'll use a system that basically uses water to float out the insulation, and it'll be collected, and they'll sell it to a slipper sole manufacturer.
You're right, China is the largest exporter of new goods to the United States, but it's also the largest importer of American recycling. I guess that makes some sense. Like, they're sending us all this stuff, and we're shipping back the used stuff we don't want anymore. kind of.
Exactly. It's the perfect example of a circular economy. And you start to hear this term circular economy in the environmental discourse. The environmental groups talk about it a lot. It's really simple almost to explain. If you think of buying a pair of Nike shoes in Los Angeles, it'll come in a cardboard box. You'll toss that cardboard box into a recycling bin. That recycling bin will eventually make its way to China, where that cardboard box will be turned into a new cardboard box for Nike and shipped back to the United States. And the circle continues. One of the things, probably one of the two most important things that makes that cycle possible is the fact that China is shipping so much new stuff to the United States in shipping containers. And to ship a container of stuff, say Nike shoes, from South China to Los Angeles, for example, costs about $2,400. But as we all know, if you just look at the trade balance figures, you know, it's the U.S. isn't shipping very much stuff back to China. So as a result, you have at these container yards in Los Angeles and in Seattle and in New York, all these containers stacked up with nothing to go back in them. So the shipping companies actually discount what they call the backhauls back to China significantly because they need those containers back in China. And so currently, and it varies a little bit, you can actually send a container of anything really, but for our purposes, a container of scrap metal or paper from Los Angeles to China for around $300. That's compared to $2,400 to ship it the other way. So that's a strong incentive to send stuff to China. But what's even more remarkable about that is if you take a look at what it costs to ship something from Los Angeles to Chicago, it's also more expensive than shipping to China. So to go by rail or truck from Los Angeles to Chicago right now is about $2,400 per container. So if it's only $300 to go to China, given the choice, you're probably going to send it to China. And not only that, that means that the buyers of scrap materials in China can actually pay more for them than the folks in Chicago. It's an incredible story of globalization that's largely hidden from view.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Adam Minter. He's the author of the new book, Junkyard Planet, about the global recycling industry. He is the Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview. Would you describe for us, like, the most amazing recycling plant that you have visited?
Yes. That is a company called Huron Valley Steel, outside of Detroit, Michigan. And Huron Valley Steel is a really interesting company. What they decided to do in the mid-1960s when the American countryside was scattered with American automobiles that couldn't be recycled, and in the early 60s, people started shredding them, and they would use magnets to pull out the steel, and then everything else left over from that car would be tossed into a landfill. Huron Valley Steel Company in the mid-60s said, we want to get that other stuff out of the car. We want to get the copper and the aluminum. We want to figure out a way to sort it. And so they developed technologies to do so. So they can take essentially a big pile of copper, aluminum, plastic, glass, and separate it into its individual components. And one of the things that they've developed the capacity to do in recent years is actually to recover the pocket change that fell between the seats in a car that was never recovered and went through the automobile shredder. So when they took me through their plant a couple of years ago, I was standing beneath a conveyor and watching coins raining down from the conveyor. What they told me was that the average American automobile is shredded with about $1.65 in change in it. And they get a significant percentage of these cars, and they are literally able to make money from the shredded cars. It's just absolutely extraordinary to see it happen.
Have you seen one of those shredder machines that can shred a car? I remember when cars were compressed into a big pancake, but it's hard for me to imagine what it's like to shred a car.
Yes, I have seen many shredders. I've seen them all over the world, and they literally eat cars. It looks like a sort of an evil roller coaster. You know, the flattened car will go up the conveyor, and then it tips into this machine that has, depending on the size of it, say two dozen 300-pound hammers, roughly the size of a large television, spinning several times per second, that just obliterates it into tiny pieces. You know, steam is coming off it. It's just an extraordinary sight. And I love to take people to these things. I've never taken somebody to an auto shredder who wasn't just absolutely gobsmacked by the scale of the machine and what it's capable of doing.
That must be a really noisy process.
It's very noisy, and I mean, when you climb into the control tower of a automobile shredder, you're almost certainly wearing ear protection. And when the car hits the hammers as they're spinning, I mean, it literally feels like an earthquake. I mean, it's just incredible. And you know, and you think about one of these machines, you know, depending on the size of the machine, I mean, they're capable of doing you know several hundred cars in a day. It's just incredible.
Before you were married, would you take dates to car shredders?
I took my wife, Christine, to a shredder in Indiana, and you know, she married me not long after that. I'm not sure if it was because of the shredder, but I'd like to think that the scrap business played a role.
Your family has been in the recycling business, the junk business, scrap metal. What's the best word?
Well, my grandmother called it the junk business. I tend to think of it as the scrap business.
Describe what your family's business was like when you were growing up.
Sure. My family started out in the business in the early 20th century, and by the time my father got into the business, it was a scrap metal business, and he separated from his uncles who had the business dating back to the early or mid 20th century. We were a scrap metal business. We probably recycled, when I was young, probably about 50 cars a day, and by recycling that meant we flattened them. We would take aluminum cans, and I would stand on the can machine weighing cans as the hobos brought in the cans. It was, like most of the scrap businesses in the United States, a family business. And so my grandmother would actually be the person who ran the scale most days of the week. So you would have these, you have this 95-pound little old Jewish lady dealing with these, you know, large semis coming through with all kinds of recyclables on them, and dealing with the truck drivers. It was a very tight-knit business, and it was very characteristic. Is a Jewish scrapyard.
So your family had a car crusher?
Yeah, we had a flattener, we call it, not a flattener car crusher. And what we'd do, and this doesn't happen now, you'd buy the cars, and I remember my father would put out price sheets for the cars, and it was, you know, a small car like a VW Beetle, I think you'd pay $20-$25 for. And what you do with the car is you'd pull out the radiator, because it has a lot of aluminum. It's an aluminum copper radiator, so that has separate value. You'd take off the catalytic converter if the car had one, because it has a platinum or other platinum group metals in it. You take off the tires and anything else that's really easy to get value out of. And then you flatten it and you'd stack it onto a truck. I remember maybe 8 to 10 high, and ship it off to North Star Steel, where the car would be shredded. We were relatively small. I mean, there are scrap yards. There's about 300 automobile shredders in the United States today, but those are multi-million-dollar machines. And so, you know, we were, if you will, poor junk. The scrappers that could afford those were rich junk. So we could afford the flattener, but our costs were low enough where it was possible for us to pull off the radiators and some of the other stuff and then send it along the line.
Would you have cars come in that were obviously in really bad accidents, and you could see that somebody was really hurt, and maybe there was even, like, you know, blood on the upholstery?
Yes, we did. I was just thinking about this the other day. I remember it was Halloween, and we received a car that had been involved in a murder-suicide of sorts, and the back seat was in a condition I don't really want to describe, but it was a bloody mess. And, you know, what do you do in that circumstance? You know, you set the car aside, call the police department, or, you know, just to make sure they know that, you know, that they've had the chance to look at this. And then you take it and you crush it. I mean, there's no time to be sentimental about it. You know, we had another instance. People are very funny about junkyards. I remember very clearly we had a guy come in with a brand new BMW and a camera crew, and he wanted to see the BMW crushed so he could film it and then let us keep it for the scrap value. That happened as well. It's very, you know, junkyards, very strange things happen in them.
What kind of protection, if any, did you have in the business? Did you have, like, the equivalent of junkyard dogs?
We did have junkyard dogs, And I can't, we stopped with the Junkyard Dogs in the late 80s, but I actually, I love Junkyard Dogs, and I try and take pictures of them at every junkyard I go to, and believe it or not, it's a real phenomenon. I was just in Ningbo, China, and I took a picture of a couple mangy Junkyard Dogs. But we did. We had Dobermans run around the scrapyard at night, believe it or not, and then there would be a security system in the office. But, you know, there's a lot of theft that happens out of these out of an open scrapyard. It's big and it's easy to get into, and so that was always a constant problem.
So the Dobermans weren't on a chain or anything; they were just loose.
Yeah. So at night, I remember we had these big kennels, and I can't remember how many we had in there. I want to say there were 3 or 4. But at night, when the gate was closed and everything, my father would open up the kennels, and the Dobermans would be running around the scrapyard at night, and then my father would come in the morning, and you know, he was one of the few people, I guess, the Dobermans didn't want to attack. He'd call them, and they'd get into their kennel, and, you know, it'd start business.
Gee. Something that I really liked about your book and about talking with you is that you're very concerned about the environmental issues, the economic and social issues, the health issues pertaining to recycling and the global recycling business. At the same time, I think because your family was in the scrap metal business and still is, that you see a certain beauty in junk and in everything that we discard.
I do. And I think there's a tremendous dignity in doing this kind of work. One of the things that's troubled me over the years as I've covered this is that the way this industry is depicted in a lot of mainstream media is depicted as the dregs, that these are not good jobs, that this is worse than the kind of recycling we do in the U.S. in green facilities. But, you know, my family came to the United States and made its living doing this. My grandmother, you know, cleaned scrap plumbing on the steps of her father's house to pay for her brother's bar mitzvah. You know, we tried to treat our employees very well. And when I travel, you know, to junkyards in Asia or, you know, in India, I very much see it through that framework, that there's dignity to this kind of work, that there is dignity to reusing and finding a way to recover value from what other people don't want. It's not something to look down upon, but it's something to be celebrated. And despite all of the problems with the industry, and they're rife, you know, I still argue that, you know, the world's a better place for these junkyards. But more than that, you know, I like to argue that, you know, the very worst recycling I've seen is still better than the best copper mine you'll ever see dug in a hole, you know, in Tibet. You know, the best oil well you'll see, you know, being drilled off the South China Sea, the best clear-cut forest. That there is, you know, we live in a very complicated world, and this business is one way maybe to disentangle some of it.
Adam Minter is the author of Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.